We have begun a study now of the final section of Genesis, starting in chapter 37. And we did that last week. Typically, these chapters 37 to 50 are known as the story of Joseph. And just some of the most beautiful and memorable moments of family reconciliation, particularly as the book wraps up. Great statement of Joseph that what his brothers meant for evil, which was largely what we looked at last week, the Lord meant for good. And it's a great story of the faithfulness of God. And yet, right at the outset, there's this other chapter that we struggle to know what to do with. And that is Genesis chapter 38. And I'd like to have you go there. And maybe as I announce the chapter, you realize why we thought it might be best to have a separate class for the children because of some of the topics that we'll have to touch on as we go through this story. This is the story of Judah and Tamar, which is challenging for us on a couple of different fronts. It's challenging for us because you read this chapter, and it really is hard to figure out what in the world it has to do with the story of Joseph. It seems like an interruption. It seems like it breaks the flow of thought. And you wonder, is this just kind of a delay to keep the suspense going until you read the rest of what happened to Joseph? Because last you heard, he was on the way down to Egypt, and you don't know what is going to come of him. But beyond that, we come to this chapter, we realize that there are some very sensitive topics, very personal topics that are mentioned here. And just from a moral standpoint and from a theme and application standpoint, it really does become difficult to know what to do with this. You may remember that we have faced these kinds of challenges before in this book. This is about the lowest that it gets, thankfully, in terms of human depravity and specifics about marriage relationships and so forth. But you might remember that when we were looking at chapter 34, I shared with you some quotes from commentators who basically said that from the viewpoint of preaching and church life, these chapters are basically useless. Really should not bring up these topics in public, and they are not helpful from a practical standpoint. And sure enough, when you come to this chapter, you find the same kind of statements. In fact, to quote Leupold again, as I did in chapter 34, he ends his discussion of this particular chapter, and he says, quote, "entirely unsuited to homiletical use, much as the devout Bible student may glean from the chapter." Not encouraging, as I've been thinking that this is the next chapter to deal with. And yet, when you try hard to put aside some of the initial struggles that you have just reading this and appreciating this as part of the Bible, you recognize that there is just a great deal of the grace and the providence of God in this story. It is fascinating from the standpoint of literature. And as we're going to see, there's been a lot of connections and a lot of ways in which this chapter actually does develop the theme of this book. But beyond that, from the standpoint of God and His character and His redemption, it is a striking and humbling and impressive display of His work. And so we're going to go into it with that mindset, looking to see what we can learn about the redemptive plan of God and how this connects to us. But the title is going to be reflective of the actual events that we find there. It is a chapter that is full of immorality of various kinds. And yet that immorality is told not just for the sake of creating interest or giving something unusual. There are all kinds of ironies in the plan of God that we're going to find as we go along here. So our title this evening, Ironic Immorality. Now, we don't want to jump into chapter 38 without having some understanding of the background of this chapter, and especially since Judah is the main character under discussion, we want to note what has been said about Judah to this point. We have not encountered him very often in Genesis so far, and we want to be sure we pay attention to what it is that has been recorded to this point. And especially as we try to do with all these stories, the words that the author chooses to put into the mouths of these characters are highly significant. Not that the author is creating those words out of the air, but that he is choosing, of all kinds of conversations that would have gone on in these people's lives, just a few little quotes that are windows into their hearts, that are suggestive of why these stories are being told. And as far as Judah is concerned, you do have a very helpful piece of background at the end of chapter 37. We encountered this last time. If you go with me to chapter 37 for a moment here, just take a look at verse 26 and 27. Remember, this is when Joseph is in the pit. And this is when the brothers had been making a plan to get rid of him. Reuben was hoping to get Joseph out of there, probably to save his own neck. But Judah has this other idea. What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And we considered those words last time, but that is all you have about Judah specifically coming into chapter 38. And you want to ask the question, what does that tell you about this man? I think it very clearly tells you a number of things. If that is all you have of all of his life so far, that's what the author chooses to give you. It tells you that this man is heartless as far as family relationships are concerned. It tells you that he will be willing to do just about anything to get himself ahead in life. It tells you that he is willing to abuse family relationships to help himself. And we noted the irony of his statement there in verse 27. Let's sell him and let not our hand be upon him, for after all, he's our brother. As if that really made any sense. If you really cared about him being your brother, you would get him out of there and treat him like a brother should. But he is choosing to use this man to get ahead and make some money. That's what we know about him. A good way to summarize his character revealed so far is with this little phrase, he is a selfish opportunist. Somebody who is always looking for a way to help himself, and very self-oriented, and a man of no principles, a man willing to stoop low to get whatever he wants. And along those lines, very ingenious in finding creative ways to help himself. That's what you know about Judah, and that's the background to chapter 38. Now, I think we could probably say a little more, because you're seeing in his life a pattern, or several patterns, that we have seen before in other people's lives. You see a lot of this kind of manipulation going on that you saw in Jacob, his own father. And last time we noted that Jacob's character is duplicated in the lives of his sons in this story. But on the other hand, I think we also see a reflection of Esau going on. And you want to be asking, as we get into chapter 38, how is Judah like some of these other characters that we have encountered so far in Genesis? We get a little hint of it here in chapter 37, and I'm going to point this out, that Judah's sale of Joseph seems to parallel another sale where Esau was willing to sell his birthright for a mess of pottage, and he didn't care about something that should have been to him in the family line very precious, very valuable. He's willing to give it away for something to feed his face. And that does not bode well as you think about what happened to Esau, what is going to happen to Judah if he continues going down this path. What else can we conclude as we try to piece things together here? Well, we always want to consider, how is God involved? What is God going to do? We know how God has dealt with Esau. We know how God has dealt with Jacob because of this sort of deceptive, self-oriented kind of approach to life. And you come into chapter 38, you begin to read that this story is going to be about Judah. And you're saying to yourself, all right, Judah's day has come. God's going to take care of him. God's going to deal with him. And you start to think back. Well, Jacob was just humiliated. And Esau was just totally rejected. Which route is it going to be for this man? And is he just going to be totally destroyed by the time we come to the end of it? I mean, pretty low thing that he did for his brother Joseph. And you're thinking it's time for God to just pull out the big guns and just totally devastate this man and break his family apart or just kill him on the spot or something. Well, he is going to be humbled through these experiences. But as you recognize that chapter 38 is the beginning of God's work, and as you think ahead to some other things that are going to happen in reference to Judah, things that you know about from later history, you recognize actually whatever the Lord does, it's going to be unspeakable grace. To think that this is the man, I mean, we know this from our vantage point, this is the man from whom the Messiah came. And the great privilege that is associated with Judah, even in book of Genesis, before it's all over, that God is just being exceedingly merciful. And what I'm saying here, that we can anticipate going through this chapter about his life, that in the end, grace is going to triumph over judgment. The Lord is not going to tolerate his sin. The Lord is going to get his attention in a huge way. But the Lord is doing this from a benevolent heart and from an ultimate purpose of blessing him. Now, as you come to chapter 38, there are other people involved. And the other main character, of course, is this lady by the name of Tamar. She's not introduced right away. But when you look at the two main divisions of the chapter, you realize that it's all about how people are interacting with Tamar. And in verses 1 to 11, you're going to find that the focus is on Tamar and her relationship to the sons of Judah. And as you read on to the rest of the chapter, which is most of it, beginning of verse 12, you're going to find that it's about Tamar relating to Judah himself. So if you can keep those two ideas, those two categories in mind, first of all, Judah's sons and Tamar, and then Judah himself interacting with Tamar, we're just going to read through the chapter. I'm going to follow those breakdowns, and I'm going to try to be pointing out some things that are significant that are going on here, trying to tie this all together, and at the end we'll conclude with the actual theme of the chapter. So we're going to do this as we often do, in an inductive way, try to discover things together, try to piece together the bits of information, and I think it will be very impressive to us about the grace of God by the time we're done. So, jumping right into verses 1 to 11, Judah's sons and Tamar. Verse 1. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And we can stop there. And first of all, note what it says in verse 1. It happened at that time. At what time? At the same time, right after Joseph was sold off into slavery, there is this other direction that Judah takes. And when you do the chronology, it's not totally clear, but basically, in these first 11 verses, you're looking at about 20 years of history summarized, which is almost the whole time that Joseph is down there in Egypt. And this is what's going on. Judah is going off on his own. He is marrying. He's having children. His sons are marrying. And there are things happening in that regard. And so you have about 20 years of his life summarized there. Now, the big thing to notice here, is the issue of his separating from his family. That did not speak well for him. It happened at that time that Judah went down from, that is, away from his brothers, and turned aside to somebody else. You remember anybody else in recent history here in Genesis who's remembered for having separated himself from his brothers and kind of going his own way, away from the covenant, away from the blessing of being in the Abrahamic family? His name was Esau. And you might have expected there to be information like this about some descendant of Esau, but here it's a descendant of Jacob who is acting like Esau, who is somebody in the main line choosing. This is not like some side figure, Esau or Lot or Ishmael. We're used to them sort of going off their own way. This is somebody right in the middle, one of the 12, who is breaking off and doing his own thing. Well, that right away is establishing another connection between Judah and Esau. Neglecting the great privilege and opportunity that he had and going off on his own. What exactly was his motive? What was happening in his heart? Why he didn't seem to care about his family? We're not totally sure here, but it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. Who is it that he chooses now to associate himself with? There is an Adullamite, and that's referring to a certain region there. This man's name was Hira. And then it says, Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua. He took her and went into her. But we never find out who specifically this woman was. We know her father's name was Shua, but her name is never identified. However, she is clearly identified by a name that does not have warm, positive associations in Genesis. She is a Canaanite. And from the beginning of this story of Abraham, going all the way back, there has been this big break between God's people and the Canaanites. And they're the ones who are under the curse of God. God is just basically waiting until their time is up so he could destroy them. And God's people are sending to their homeland to get the wives for their sons. And as soon as you start having connections maritally with the Canaanites, you know you're headed for trouble. Okay? That happened with Esau, particularly. And we know what became of him. So, that does not bode well for the events coming up here, that you're dealing with a man who, like Esau in chapter 36 and verse 6, separated himself from his brothers, and beyond that, started to interact very intimately with Canaanite people. And remember, this book originally was given to the group of people going into Canaan to destroy the wicked. And they are being warned and challenged in different ways throughout these stories about the dangers of close association with the ungodly. And here is, among other things, an example of the kinds of things that happen when those walls of separation are broken down. Now, moving on to the next few verses. We might have expected at this point, I mean, we already know what he did to Joseph. Now he's separating from the covenant family. Now he's marrying the Canaanites. We might have expected it to say in the next verse, and like God did to Sodom and Gomorrah, he rained down fire and brimstone and destroyed Judah. But actually, what happens is the very opposite. This man is blessed with the very thing that throughout Genesis everybody's been wanting, which is what? Kids. The seed promise. Because we know that the seed is the means by which God is going to advance his kingdom in the world. And everybody's looking for the final seed, the seed of the woman who would crush the head of the serpent. And this man, for all of his wrong steps, just in rapid fire succession, his wife conceived, bore a son, called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. that is not insignificant. Given what? Given how much trouble the women among God's people have had in having babies in this book. And the struggle and the long waiting that takes place. And the prayer and the agonizing to have children. And here's this guy, Judah, and it's like bang, bang, bang. He gets all the kids. What's going on there? And again, we're seeing a window into where God is moving him and how God is blessing him eventually. Interesting. Not totally sure if this is significant, but when it says there at the end that Judah was in Chesiv when she bore him, that name is based upon a word, a verb that means lies or to lie in the verb form. And what it means is that if the place was named on purpose to reflect that word, the name of the city basically is the place of being lied to, or the city of lies, which is suggestive because there's going to be a lot of deception going on before this is over. But let's read on here as to what's going to happen with the sons of Judah. And this is where we get into some of the more challenging information. Verse 6, Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Now, as far as we can tell, Tamar was a Canaanite from this area, just like Judah's own wife was. And so he is not only neglecting his own spiritual commitments, but he is neglecting the spiritual health of his children by finding a wife for his son, from among the women of the land, a Canaanite, Tamar. But right away, it says in verse 7, something that we don't know a whole lot about. Judah, his firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. What exactly was the wickedness that he committed, or why God was so angry with him to have done this, we're not entirely sure. But it certainly is indicative of how the degeneration happens from one father to a son to the next generation on down. It just gets worse and worse, to where Jacob had his issues and Judah is struggling with those same character weaknesses in a pronounced degree, and now the next generation, it has gotten so bad that gets the distinction of being the first man in the Bible that was personally executed by God. How'd you like that to go down as your claim to fame? God had wiped out whole cities or the whole world with a flood, but it has never said so far, the Lord slew him. And yet that's what it says for this particular man. That's quite a distinction. Is the first person in Scripture that we're told was personally executed by God. What's going to happen next? In verse 8, Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for her brother. Now, that may ring a bell if you're thinking ahead to the book of Deuteronomy, or if you're thinking ahead to the book of Ruth, that when the law was written, God actually said that when a man died without having any children, it was the responsibility of his brother to take up the wife and have children through her. And evidently, that was not just something the Lord thought of on the spot, but it was a long custom, because you're talking about hundreds of years before the law that Judah is talking this way. And apparently there was this custom, some version of that here, reflected in Judah's thinking. Now, we're again not totally sure about some of the details here, because it doesn't say take your brother's wife as your own wife. And it may be that in this early stage, they weren't required to actually marry the woman, but just to have relations with her enough in order to have a child that would then be standing in the place of the dead brother. And this is what Judah asks Onan to do. What's Onan going to do about it? Well, again, his character is more and more twisted. As time goes on, the generations of the wicked get worse and worse. Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. Meaning what? Meaning that in terms of the inheritance, he would miss out on his own son by his own wife, would miss out on at least a portion of the family inheritance that would normally go to the firstborn. And he's saying, wait a minute, this is not a good deal. Here I am basically promoting my brother's family and losing some of the piece of the pie for myself. And I don't know if I want to do this. And that kind of selfishness that we saw in Judah's life is now reproduced in Onan's life. And then it says, whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as not to give offspring to his brother. And the wording there is very precise because it is not saying that this happened one time, but that this was a characteristic action on his part to make sure, as much as humanly possible, that he would not give her what she needed for this son, for his brother to be born. Now, that's a bit of a difficulty, raises all kinds of questions and speculations in our minds, and I don't want to get too embroiled here. But let me just comment on this, because there have been people who have used this particular verse for a number of things, and we want to be sure we pick up on the main point of the statement. I would say, primarily here, we don't want to take this as some kind of Bible statement reference to birth control. Okay? As you go on to read, the Lord is angry about what took place. What he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and God puts him to death also. This is not, in this context, talking about birth control primarily. In fact, what I would venture to say is that the fact that he thought to do this, the fact that this is something that occurs to him, indicates this was a method of birth control that was practiced normally at this time when people wanted to limit the size of their families. And this was one of the methods, and it just was something that went on customarily. God does not comment on that specifically. You really are hard-pressed in the Bible to come up with anything clearly on this particular topic that would indicate one way or another that there is a right and wrong on that particular question. But that is just not the point here. What's the problem? The problem is not he did not want to have children, period. The problem is not birth control is a problem. The problem is he was unwilling to carry on the family line. And when you consider that in Genesis, everything has to do with the family line and seed and descendants, and particularly thinking ahead to Judah and who he is and the role he's to play, Judah has got to have a baby. His wife, somehow, through his family, it's got to move on. That is just central to this whole thing. And here's a man who cares nothing about that, just because he wants more money for his own family. And God says, we're not going to tolerate that. That kind of lack of commitment to the main thing I'm doing in the world, which is blessing all families of the earth through the line of Abraham, and you don't want to be a part of that, that's like the worst thing you could possibly do in Genesis. And God says, you have just utterly disqualified yourself. And again, he strikes him on the spot. He becomes person number two who is personally executed by the Lord. So You want to see this as selfishness that's just growing generation after generation. And Judah's selfish disregard for the covenant line is magnified in Onan, who is also executed. Now, Judah starts to get a little worried about Tamar, wondering if there's something wrong with this woman, that now she has evidently killed off two men, and maybe a little superstitious as some of these people were. And so, knowing his responsibility, he makes this promise to her. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah my son grows up. For he feared that he would die like his brothers." So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. Now, it's very helpful that the writer is writing from what we call an omniscient perspective. In other words, he knows what's going on in people's hearts because the Holy Spirit is telling him. And so he explains to us what the point is. Judah says this, wait until my other son grows up, but all along he doesn't intend to give his son to her. He is concerned that he might get killed as well. And furthermore, he just totally goes back on his responsibility in saying, you go back to your father's house and just wait. Again, given everything you know in Genesis, a man whose father and mother is joined to his wife, and this is a new family that's created in the patterns that have been going on here. It's the responsibility of the new family to provide for the widow. And he says, just go back. And in his heart, never intending to do anything for her again. And that's the end of that first section. That's the summary of his life. Judah reneges on his daughter-in-law, but risks having no descendant at all. Summary of his life so far. Let me make a comment about the no descendant part. Here's a situation. Judah has at least given his word that Shelah is going to be married to Tamar. He doesn't intend to do that. Unless Judah has another son who then gets married, who then has a baby, the line is not going to continue. And so he's in what we might call a catch-22. Do I give my son to her? And it seems like maybe he's going to get killed too. Or do I withhold him? But if I withhold him, then how am I going to have any children? How's this going to go on? Possibly I could have another son, but as you get into the next section, what's the very next thing that you read? In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. So that option is eliminated. Now you're really stuck. If this line is going to go on, it's going to have to be through Shelah. But Shelah has been promised to Tamar, which is not what Judah intends, and so you're stuck. What's going to happen here to continue the line of the covenant? Well, that becomes the question as we come to the second section. Moving on from the interaction between Judah's sons and Tamar, and look at Judah himself and Tamar in verses 12 to 30. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. Again, we don't know all of the chronology here, but as you look at the amount of time that you have to work with and the amount of time that it would take for those sons to be born and be old enough to be married in the first place, and the window of time that you have total, when it says in the course of time, that may have been about a year or two. And within that span, what you find is that Judah's wife dies. And then when Judah was comforted, and it makes it sound like that was a relatively short period of time, because it comes around to the next season for shearing the sheep as the next main event. Now, the question is, have you read recently here anything about people mourning the loss of a loved one and being comforted or not being comforted? Okay? There is something, and there's also what it says in verse 13 about Tamar. Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. She took off her widow's garments. Now, again, we're not totally sure about the time frame here, but here's somebody else who's mourning, and apparently for all of this time, she has remained committed to this promise of Shelah. In fact, she considers herself a widow, and she's dressed like a widow, and her hopes are set on that son number three. The impression you get is Judah's wife dies. It doesn't take him very long to get over that and move on. And what he's going to do next is just horrendous. And yet, for a longer span, Tamar, who's the wicked Canaanite, has been mourning the loss of her husband or husbands. And if you're asking anything about this before, well, you had somebody just uncontrollably grieving in chapter 37. And that, of course, is Jacob when he heard the story about Joseph. And I'm saying this is a part of negatively picturing Judah and starting to put a positive perspective on Tamar. Judah's relatively brief sorrow contrasts with the more convincing sorrow of Tamar and the profound sorrow of Jacob in chapter 37. Well, what's going to happen next? When Tamar finds out about this, she takes off those garments and she dresses up. She uses clothes to conceal her true identity and to deceive somebody. Does that ring a bell? We're seeing a lot of what we might call echoes. Remember, our title was Ironic Immorality. I've made several points, and there's more to come, of how these things that seem to be happening, that A, are so wicked, and that sometimes people are deciding to do just off the cuff, are strikingly similar to a lot of other things that have happened. As though there's this God in heaven who's almost laughing. How everything starts to look the same, and everybody's falling into these patterns somehow in the mysteries of his providence, and end up unwittingly contributing to what he intended to do in the first place. It's just remarkable. And it's going to get more and more that way as we go along. The use of garments to deceive, which we read about there in verse 14 and verse 15, is reminiscent, first of all, of the time that Jacob dressed up to deceive his father and stole Esau's blessing. And then, of course, the fact that the brothers of Joseph took his garments and dipped them in blood and used that garment to deceive their father, Jacob. Everybody is fooling everybody with the use of clothes repeatedly here. Verse 14, she covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, sat at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not that prostitutes covered their faces, but that he couldn't identify her as Tamar because she had covered her face. A couple of fascinating things about those verses. I mentioned the point about the name of a city already. Do you know what the word Enaim means? It says here the entrance to Enaim, but literally that says the opening of eyes. And this is going to be the event through which Judah's eyes are opened as to what's really going on from God's standpoint. Reading on in that little passage, another point that's made positively about Tamar She saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. And here, again, she seems more concerned about the real values of this family than Judah does. She's concerned about marriage. What she does in the next few verses is a ploy to what? It's a ploy to get children, to continue the family line. And again, you have this wicked Canaanite. Nobody's going to justify what she did now. But at least she had a right motive. And she cared more about the seed than Judah did. And we're going to read about that as we go on here in verse 16. He turned to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come into you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So at least we know that he did not knowingly commit incest here. He was deceived about that. And nevertheless, he is still engaging with what, as far as he knows, is a prostitute. And based upon the language later on, a cult prostitute. Meaning what? Meaning that there wasn't just immorality going on, but that this woman in her community, as you read on, was assumed to have been doing that in connection with the pagan rituals of the idol-worshipping peoples among the Canaanites. And this is the stuff that now Judah is getting embroiled with. And again, his wife has not been dead all that long. And on the spot, he just almost flippantly says, "Come, let me come into you." His carnal character is further revealed in verse 16 by that quick proposal to a prostitute. Now, what happens next is just fascinating. Maybe Tamar had been coming up with this plan for a long time, but it's really, in a twisted way, it's a beautiful plan. In other words, it's a stroke of genius that she has as to how to deal with the seed, the birth of descendants. What has she said? "What will you give me that you may come into me?" He answered, "I will send you a young goat from the flock." Have we read anything about goats before? Who deceived his father by feeding him goat meat? And in the blood of what animal was Joseph's coat dipped? But the blood of a goat that these men had killed, and now the goat, in this case, enters into the picture in this other very questionable transaction. So that's another stroke of the providence of God, that her ploy has to do with a goat, yet another striking connection with the Esau and Joseph incidents. Now, the folly of Judah at this point is just incredible. When she says, "All right, if you give me a pledge until you send it." And he says, "All right, what pledge shall I give you?" And she replies, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." What's going on there? A signet was a piece of metal or some other object that would have some identifying symbol to it that an individual could use, for example, to stamp his signal, his sign or his name, his signature into a piece of wax. So it was something very specific, almost like a stamp would be today. And it typically hung around your neck on a cord, on a necklace of some kind. Your staff, of course, these people worked with animals, often had some other kind of identifying symbol at the top that was related to your family and such. And that's what she asked for, something unmistakably identifying Judah as the man. And so he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Someone had said that this would be today the equivalent of giving your credit card to a prostitute. In other words, something that would very clearly identify you, that could be used against you, your ID card, your driver's license, to where there would be no question as to who the father of this baby is. I mean, it's just unarguably Judah. No way he can get out of it when the pressure is on. And then you have the fact that in this one-time encounter, the woman gets pregnant. Now, women only get pregnant a very small number of days out of the month. And it just so happened that this was the time for her. And particularly given what we have already commented on in the book of Genesis about how hard it is for the people of God to have children, because God's really trying to make it clear that he's the one who gives pregnancy. This woman, one time, in a very strange situation, with her father-in-law, gets pregnant. How did that happen? You meant it for evil, God meant it for good. That is what's happening here. Unbelievable. Now, moving on, she very quickly arose and went away, taking off her veil, put on the garments of her widowhood. And now, Judah is going to have to take care of his financial obligation. And it says in verse 20, when Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to take back the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find it. And he asked the men of the place, where is the colt prostitute who was at Enaim at the roadside? And they said, no colt prostitute has been here. So he returned to Judah and said, I have not found her. Also the men of the place said, no colt prostitute has been here. And Judah replied, let her keep the things as her own, or we shall be laughed at. You see, I sent this young goat, and you did not find her. A couple things stand out to me there about Judah. First of all, he sends this by the hand of a messenger. Why didn't he take care of it himself? There's a lot of saving of face that's going on here. And again, to notice, what are the only words that are coming out of his mouth as the story is told? There's no conviction here. There's not even, boy, that was a really dumb thing to do. Just saying, nah, just let her keep it. Or we're going to be laughed at. You're my witness. I tried to send the payment. In other words, he's very self-focused still, just concerned about his own reputation at this point. And I think that ought to be incorporated into our understanding as well. We cannot pay the debt. We just keep hearing the same thing we've been hearing so far. Self-interest. It's all about how's this going to reflect on me. And now the big surprise to him in verse 24. About 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she's pregnant by immorality. And Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Amazing that this could be his response. And again, very few words that come out of his mouth, and that's what comes out of his mouth. I mean, that's not only, the way I worded it here in the point, it's not only selfish. I mean, it's just hypocritical to the point of being ridiculous. That he's all up in arms, all indignant about, oh, look what she's done. Going all along that he's guilty of the same kind of immoral behavior. And thankfully we can see right through it. He probably, speaking to the selfishness, he probably was thinking, okay, here's my opportunity. This woman's out of the picture. We're going to burn her and execute her to the nth degree of the law. That gives me an opportunity to get another wife for Sheila, and we can have children, and the thing can go on. And yet there is this hypocrisy, this accusing somebody and going after somebody for something he himself was guilty of. Now, verse 25, as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, by the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant. And she said, please identify whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. And we'll stop there for a moment. Those words, please identify. I would expect would have rung in the ears of Judah before he even heard the part about the signet and so forth. Because those are precisely the words that they, when they sent the coat dipped in blood to Jacob, said to Jacob, please identify. You read it there in chapter 37, verse 34. The Hebrew terminology is exactly the same thing. Genesis chapter 37 and verse 32. They sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, this we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe. And he identified it and said, go back to chapter 38. That's exactly now what Judah is going to do. Verse 26. Then Judah identified them and said, you see that? The fingerprints of God all over this very twisted situation. And he gets the same words and the same deception that he had presented to his father. No way he can get out of it. And so he finally makes a confession, which may not seem like very much, but in the context of everything we've heard about Judah so far, it actually is huge. Particularly the fact that he's referring to a prostitute. She is more righteous than I. That's quite an indictment. When you look at a prostitute, your own daughter-in-law who's dressed up as a prostitute, and you confess, she is more righteous than I. Not a very flattering statement to make. And why is she more righteous than you? Well, in a sense, she had a right to be in our family and have children. And I was the one that withheld from her my son, and she cared more about this family loyalty and this having children than I did. That's specifically what he's referring to. But it is, as well, a recognition of the selfishness that we have seen coming out of his heart all the way through. Judah acknowledges that Tamar cared more about descendants than he did, signaling a recognition of his characteristic selfishness. And this is not the end of the story, but it's like we saw with Jacob back in chapter 32. What happened at the river there was not a total transformation, but it was a turning point. And it began a process that led, in the end, to a very different individual. And this one statement, she is more righteous than I, represents a change of heart. And you know that that is the case. It's suggested by the fact that he did not know her again. In other words, he recognizes the inappropriateness of this relationship, and he withholds himself from her. And yet we have just a little bit more left as far as the babies that are going to be born. And let's read here verse 27 to 30. When the time of her labor came, there were twins in her womb. And when she was in labor, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. And she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. Therefore his name was called Perez, which is the word related to breach. Afterward, his brother came out with a scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Does any of that sound familiar? There are all kinds of further connections with previous stories, more links with the life of Jacob. You have twins being born. You have a surprise in that the younger is able to usurp the elder. Jacob came out hanging on to the heel of his brother. In this case, the brother sort of fights his way out. And even the fact that the thread around his hand was scarlet or red is reminiscent as well of what happened with the red stuff that led to the name Edom, that Esau was willing to give up his birthright for. Now, what about the names of these individuals? They are significant as well. Again, in the providence of God, with these people sort of on the spot, based on these very fast events are coming up with are suggestive of what has just taken place. I believe the names of those sons parallel what is happening in Judah's life. The name Perez, which has to do with breaking out, a breakthrough, we might say, or a breach, as the word is here, I believe that is suggestive that God has begun to break through into Judah's life and begin a work there. And you know what Zerah means? It's a word that refers to dawn. And we have seen that word, at least a term in the same family from the same root, back in chapter 32 and verse 32. Verse 31 gives us the actual word as far as the incident with Jacob. After his night of wrestling with God, the sun rose upon him as he passed. It's a word that means dawn. It's a term that's used there, reference to the sun rising, meaning that there is a new day that is dawning, just like limping Jacob is going on to a new day with God. Now, Judah, his son's name, is Dawn, and God is beginning to shine upon him. Now, we've suggested some things, and I want to try to wrap this up now as far as the point of the story. We want to remember where sin abounded, grace did much more abound throughout these stories. But that grace is operating in different ways and on different levels. It's operating on this huge historical level of all that God is setting up for his plan to bring in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so the nation has to develop and they need to have a land and all of that. But it's also happening on this micro level as God's grace and redemption are at work to restore these individual patriarchs to himself and to his image. So that's what we want to ask. That would be a good way, if you're trying to review these stories about the patriarchs, good way to kind of get at the bottom line is, what is the grace on the macro level and what's the grace on the micro level of their life? Let's start on the micro level. Here's what's happening. Very clearly, God has used the results of this man's sins to begin a transformation process. It is just starting, but that statement, "she is more righteous than I," is huge. Now, we're not going to read any more about Judah for a good while, because in chapter 39, the camera switches back to Joseph. But before too long, those two individuals, their lives are going to merge back together. And what you have in chapters 37 and 50 is not simply the Joseph story. It's actually a double plot of things God is doing in Joseph and through Joseph, and things that God is doing in Judah and through Judah, and those two individuals are going to come back together. It's going to take a while to get there, and I'm not going to give the story away, but if you're really anxious to find out, you read chapter 44, which is a huge long speech that Judah gives. And his heart is totally different than anything we have encountered about his life so far. We're going to get to that, but it's very encouraging at this point that God has begun a work. On the macro level, what do we see going on? Well, I've already suggested this. This might be the first thing that comes to mind when we think the name Judah. This is the line through whom the Messiah would be born. And in chapter 49 and verse 10, Jacob says that the royalty is going to be associated with Judah. The verse says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and unto him shall the gathering of the peoples be." And there's a long line of development that includes chiefly King David in the Old Testament. And you read the genealogy of Jesus Christ, and it doesn't mention just Judah, but it mentions his wife, at least the woman through whom his children were born, Tamar. graft it into the line of Goth Messiah, where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. It wasn't just about giving him children. It was about bringing Christ into the world. But I think we can see more, considering the fact that Tamar was a Canaanite, and that there were very questionable things involved in what she did. I do think she's presented positively, and she is presented as a woman of commitment to some degree, though she had very problematic methods that she followed. But she was a Canaanite, and all this started because of too close connection with Canaanites. And you would have thought that if God was really after the Canaanites, he would have somehow wiped her out of the way, found a new wife or something. But it's the Canaanite that sort of grafted in after all. And that's a part of the point. I would say that another macro thing that's happening is that God is using Judah's sin to keep developing his viewpoint on the nations, those pagan peoples. First of all, the importance of separation from the ungodly. But even beyond that, his intent to redeem people out of all families of the earth. So much so that this Canaanite prostitute ends up being an ancestress of the Messiah. She is grafted in. And you know what? Thinking about that original audience again, these people reading this book for the first time are going to be the same ones who go into Jericho, and there's going to be a Canaanite prostitute there that's grafted in at the very beginning of the conquest. If they had been connecting the dots, they would realize, hey, this is not the first time this has happened. And now let me have you go to the book of Matthew that I mentioned, and just point this out about the line of Christ. In Matthew chapter 1, it mentions Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar in verse 30. And then look at this in verse 5. And Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab. And of course, Boaz pretty quickly gets you to David. And in connection with that, you have another woman who wasn't supposed to be in the picture either, Ruth, the Moabitess, who comes from very questionable backgrounds. Just amazing how God is bringing together all these strands of events to contribute to his great redemptive plan.